Good morning, everybody. This is Brant DiPalermo with Champion Corrosion Products. I'd like to welcome you to our first virtual meeting. We'll be doing online. One quick announcement I wanted to make before we get started is we've been planning on the Eagleford short course to go ahead and move forward and have that in February. And that will be based on the guidelines with all the COVID stuff going on, based on the city of New Braunfels and the Civic Center. So keep an eye on it. As we get closer, we will have a definite answer of whether or not we will be able to host that event this year or not. Today, we're going to have our presentation is going to be by Cal Chapman with Chapman Engineering. And the topic he will be speaking on is pipeline integrity management. So Cal, if you'd like to go ahead and get started, go ahead.
Okay, Brant, thank you very much. And I'm just going to launch in. When I give this presentation and similar ones in person, I always invite the audience to ask me questions whenever it may strike them. Today, since we're online, if you want to use this chat box and ask me something, you're welcome to do so. If you want to try to get in by unmuting and interrupting verbally, that's fine with me. I want this to be as interactive as we can make it. Second comment I'll make at this beginning is there's a whole lot of content here, but lots and lots of pictures. So I think we'll move through it pretty fast. And Cindy, we have 45 minutes, 50 minutes, and then maybe question and answer. Is that about right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, very good. So there's the set of introductory slides. I'm going to be talking about mainly oil and gas assets today, but please understand, when we talk about pipeline integrity, I do mean it to be described as broader than just pipelines. It can be bulk tanks. It can be big facilities. It can be electric power plants. It can be water and wastewater plants. So all the principles I'm going to touch on, I think, will tell us other assets it applies to as well. Now let me figure out how to advance the slides. So what is pipeline integrity? What is asset integrity? I think our main issue is that we want to keep the product on the inside of whatever that asset is, not let it get away from us. And of course, we have to keep products moving, make money, do our jobs safely, properly, effectively. We have to design and build new assets. Cost effectively, yeah, but we have to be technically effective. We need them to be operated and maintained cost effectively. If you have a lot of leaks on a new system, is that a cheap system to operate? I don't think so. So why is asset integrity management important? We want to minimize the costs of operation over time. I see so many companies put a lot of cost into design and not as much cost into inspection during construction, and not as much good engineering into how are we going to operate this cost effectively over a very long haul. You want to manage your integrity risks, reduce those costs related to failure, and keep your liabilities down. What does it cost to buy your insurance? If you do a better job of design and construction and inspection and operation, maybe you save money on insurance. When does asset integrity management begin? To me, it's with the design. If it's an existing asset, yeah, we're too late for that. This is a project I got to work on back in the 1970s. Yes, I am that old. And yes, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline is still in use, doing pretty well. This was a fall 2015 project out in the Permian, and it's the red pipe I'll be talking about, crossed by the big green pipe. Actually, we dug the red, well, the installers put the red pipe under the green pipe, of course. And what did we have a reason to dig this hole for? That was about 30% wall loss found by ILI and due to external corrosion after only 3 years in service. You want a crowded corridor? Our 30-inch line was crossed 42 times in 2.5 miles, foreign current involvement from CP systems was terrible. We got some of it corrected, not all of it corrected. I'm an engineer. You all probably have seen that, the PE behind my name. So that means I like to go to engineering documents, engineering societies, and I look at a whole bunch of smart people who've put together great processes, great evaluation techniques before me. How about the American Society of Mechanical Engineers creating these major threat categories for pipelines? And this dates back to as early as 1935. We don't have to invent integrity management. The tools are out there for us to grab. Look at this list, the major threat categories, and not listed in ranked order. External and internal corrosion, stress corrosion, cracking, third-party damage, manufacturing defect, fabrication and joining, equipment failure, incorrect operations, weather and outside force. Why did they come up with this short list? Because every one of these is meaningful, it's understandable, and you can kind of put brackets around it and say, that problem fits this particular category. The very top risk on this is still third-party damage after all these years of us doing 811 nationwide. March of 2016, we had crews up in the Bakken of North Dakota, and a very small pipeline leak showed up. Our survey crew crossed this area, and what do you see in the photo? The light brown milky stuff is an oil fraction. The other ponding is produced water, very salty water, of course, and you have a little bit of rainbowing out farther on to the back. So this was a multi-phase product pipeline, just a flow line from a wellhead to some other larger line. And we found the leak probably quite soon after it started. A similar leak that happened very nearby a few years before caused acres and acres of saltwater damage to prime farmland. That was an expensive problem to deal with. Look at this pipe. I was not familiar with this kind of pipeline before this hole got dug. Let me go to the next photo to get you up close and personal to this thing. This is a fiberglass reinforced plastic pipe made to be flow lined for crude oil. And it's a glued and screwed set of joints. So we actually see a joint right here if my mouse is on the screen. The red arrow points to this diagonal crack in the fiberglass reinforced plastic pipe. And that was basically on the winding of fibers. So that crack right there under fairly low pressure gave us that emulsion, oil and produced water release up to the ground surface and down to some depth in the soil. It was not a big release in total barrels lost, but look at the next photo. What caused it to happen? Oops, sorry. What threats caused it? I gotta go back to the first photo. Do you see the dip in this fiberglass pipe right here? This company buried two new steel pipelines under this pipe, maybe a year or 2 or 3 years before the leak. And they basically stressed this fiberglass pipe by their new backfill not being well compacted around this pipe. It slumped and sagged and dragged this pipe into that bending, which is what caused the crack. So now we'll go to the threat list and say, what were the causes? This is equipment failure of the pipe, with the pipe being bent by soil compaction. I'll call it incorrect operations, and then I'll call it outside force with that soil stress involved. Fiberglass pipe, we didn't have a corrosion problem. Manufacturing defect, I wouldn't say so, because the pipe got put into service and did just fine before it got bent and cracked. Small pipeline, is that a small deal? One pipe at a time, it's a small deal. But we all understand that the miles of flow line and gathering line pipelines are huge. This was a well count by the U.S. Energy Information Administration as of 2015. So this count is low. We've added, I'm sure, another couple hundred thousand wells in the last 5 years. So all that data right there, then you look at other infrastructure that's, again, suffering from integrity-related issues. Last comment here, when will a pipeline become less regulated? Answer, never. We just had the MAGL rule start to hit us this last summer. So the regulatory framework for pipelines across the U.S., I think everybody on the call is familiar with 49 CFR 192 for natural gas, Part 199 for hazardous liquids. Integrity management program work really got formalized from 2002 through 2007 for virtually all the pipeline networks out there. And just recently, thanks to MAGL rule, July 1st of 2020, we're adding more classes of pipeline type to what's being regulated by the feds. Sometimes states have more stringent requirements than the feds do, sometimes not. Spill response requirements are very often stricter at the state level than they are at federal level, in my experience. I am not going to dwell on the next 10 or 12 slides a lot. They recite what the rules say. But for classifying gas pipelines, we all know we have class 1 through class 4, 4 being the highest risk area. And now we're going to see not just high consequence areas, but soon medium consequence areas also be included in how we classify. Again, the classes from 1 to 4 define the increasing risk level related to that pipeline being there and being operated. Medium consequence areas coming in. So we're looking at populated areas, drinking water sources, and unusually sensitive ecological features or resources, all bringing us into a high consequence area defined for a particular location or group of locations. We have to have integrity management plans specific to a dry natural gas pipeline, if that's what you're operating. Specific to a hazardous liquids pipeline, if that's what you're operating. The integrity management program that a large pipeline company may have is one portion of this overall integrity management approach. An integrity management plan has to be created for each individual regulated pipeline. Not each pipeline is the same as every other, as we well know. Anybody seen this picture before? I sat down next to a guy in my January 2009 CP4 class out in California. This was his pipe. September of 2008, a 42-inch dry natural gas pipeline let loose. This was a little bit outside of Appomattox, Virginia. So that explosion and fireball, the long dimension in that drawing right there, is more than 1,100 feet. And if anybody can see my mouse on the screen, that house right there, a gentleman and his wife were getting ready to drive to work, again, not long before 8 o'clock in the morning, and they heard a huge roar start just like that. And the man immediately snapped to, hey, that's gotta be the pipeline, we don't have jets flying over. He and his wife ran to the garage, got into their car, and drove the car out of the back wall of the garage, away from the sound, drove to the road upper left, and drove away at high speed, and then the fireball lit off. They were extremely lucky, of course. This was an external corrosion problem on the long seam of a 1955-era pipe. And a smart tool run done only months earlier did not pick up any of that. Many of us know that long seams are not easy to evaluate unless you use a specific type of tool on the pig. So there was obviously a bill to be paid by the pipeline company. And then the regulator said, yeah, you get to pay us $1 million also. This is an aerial view that I pulled off of Google just a year, year and a half ago. You see the white line that I laid in on the pipe route. no evidence of what happened 10 years before this. But look at that little white line that I have crossing the bigger white line to the upper right. That is a line reaching out 220 yards in each direction. That's the size of the reach each side of the pipe. You're supposed to slide along the pipeline route, count the number of dwellings, and decide how you class locate this piece of pipe. This was class one or class two area, low regulatory thresholds compared to high consequence areas. Natural gas pipeline requirements out of 192. These tables tell you all the different things that are called out. I'm just going to zip right through them. I hope many of you know these like the back of your hand because you're using them so regularly. Here's another accident. And this one happened August 1st of 2018 when I was supposed to go up to Denver and give a presentation on pipeline integrity about 3 weeks later. A good friend of mine is on the volunteer fire department in Greenwood, just east of Midland. These pictures are not all his, this picture is not his. The rest you're going to see are his. One pipeline worker was killed. Four others went to the burn unit at Texas Tech. The first pipeline ruptured, and everybody responded to it. This is an approximate location looking at Railroad Commission mapping. And I actually drove by this going to the NACE Permian clay shoot back in February of 2019. So some months later, I couldn't see the location directly, but I did see the wet draw and a bunch of salty soils. And this shows you about where the rupture took place. So we're in a draw. Everybody in the local area knew that this draw stayed wet. There's a pond right here along the farm road. There's a pond here. There's a little pond here. There's plenty of water saturating this area. And then we had CP interference according to people with local knowledge. So here's the first fireball after it had died down. On a 12-inch natural gas pipeline, there were five pipes in the corridor. I've learned since that this first pipeline operator shut in the pipe. They closed the valve, which means they backbuilt local pressure, so the only way to reduce pressure was to keep feeding the fire. They should have left all the valves open. Them causing the valves, NTSB still hasn't written a report, but I'm going to say them closing the valves probably caused the next explosion. The line right beside the first one ruptured and immediately exploded in a huge fireball. There were four pipeline workers who had walked into the area trying to look at stuff when the second one let loose. Again, one guy died. Those three others were all critically burned. My firefighter friend went to the hospital. He was the fourth hospitalization. I'm going to back up a picture, and you can see his brush truck right there in great condition. Thankfully, the big fire truck spraying right here had backed out and gotten away before the second rupture and fireball, but that's what happened to his brush truck. He and his firefighters were standing behind it toward the red vehicle you see in the background. And it's only the brush trucks being there that probably either saved their lives or kept them out of the burn unit in Lubbock. Hazardous liquids lines, this is the recitation of requirements on them out of the federal rule. Again, I'm not going to dwell on this. Anybody's got questions, bring them to us. So how do we assess existing pipelines under the IM rules? If we're looking at external corrosion, most often we're going to use either external corrosion direct assessment, which is very well described in NACE standards, or we're going to use smart gauges, inline inspection, or ILI tools. And depending on how much risk there is involved in a particular piece of the corridor, we may do both. For monitoring of internal corrosion, there is internal corrosion direct assessment, another NACE standard, ICDA. Smart pigs are used a lot to look for internal corrosion damage. We can use monitoring of coupons, looking at chemical residuals, maybe some other types of real-time probes mounted inside these pipes. How frequently do we want to assess existing pipelines? It depends partly on rule language. It depends very much on how much risk you've got. 3-year to 5-year cycles are common. Some people may go out to 7 years if they're really in low consequence areas. But all these processes are based on us doing continuous improvement. It is that plan, do, check, act cycle. We never stop on that. Every set of data we get, we add it to the data from before. We try to look at trends. We, of course, try to pick out the worst stuff that we should deal with. But looking at trends and getting a better idea of what the future holds for us is crucial every time around. There is also a direct assessment technique for stress corrosion cracking. If you've got old pipes, sour service history, that's important to you. So assessing existing pipelines, the number one slide approach. ECDA, when you use this, has to have two different and complementary survey types applied. Close interval survey is most often one of those. Makes a lot of sense to use that as long as you've got CP that you can manage with good quality synchronized interruption. A second survey then with a different approach is going to be used. And these two survey types have got to have different strengths and different weaknesses from one another. So when you combine the sets of data, you hopefully have no area of concern left that's going undiscovered. Just a quick illustration of how we want cathodic protection to be interrupted so that we can look at those instant off readings and get a sense of how much electrochemical polarization shift we're accomplishing across the entire length of line. So other ECDA surveys, DCVG, direct current voltage gradient, we see it used a lot, but usually as a hotspot technique, not as common to use it down the entire length of a pipeline, unless you're doing it on a brand new line before commissioning. ACVG, alternating current voltage gradient, can be used either on a hotspot basis or down the entire length of a line. And when conditions are good for it, it can be very valuable. We use a tool called C-Scan that looks at coating conductance quality. And that can be done over long stretches of pipeline, quite fast, very cost effective. But it suffers from interference from high voltage and medium voltage AC power. So we are knocked out of some pieces of right-of-way because of that. The Pearson survey is not something we see used really anymore. Some of the old-timers on the call are going to know that one, and they can tell you more about it, but not meant for this moment. Smart digs. What can they do, and how do we use them? Smart tools are fantastic when everything goes well, you have a very clean pipe, and the people running the tool know what they're doing. If the pipeline is clean and the geometry is piggable, then this is almost always a great approach to use. You can put calipers on the pig that will check the pipe for roundness, can pick up dents, can find changes in diameter, which, believe it or not, do occur on the same pipeline. Magnetic flux leakage as a particular type of tool, that is on virtually every smart pig, and it is a not quite do-it-all tool, but it is a versatile tool. I talked earlier about a long seam issue on that pipeline in Appomattox, Virginia area. EMAT is a crack detection tool.
Its use history is mostly good. It has missed some things. You can use ultrasonic tool pieces for long seam looks if you have a conductive fluid on the inside. Ultrasonic doesn't work with dry natural gas unless you run the tool inside a slug of liquid. And that may be a good approach for some folks. So here's one smart pig picture from a few years ago. And this one, I can tell you there's others out there now that make this one look small and not very complicated. Some of these things now are 15 feet long. Are smart pigs the answer? Well, they're excellent tools up to a point. If you have a piggable line, then yeah, use them. If you don't have a piggable line, the mega rule is going to start making people with bad geometry pipelines fix a lot of that stuff, make them piggable. Some cases, it's not practical to do that. You're still locked out of using smart pigs on some old pipelines. What we do see, though, very frequently, even now, is 80 to 90% of the smart pig data is reported out to you by the vendor as really good quality. It's not 100% good. They have speed excursions. They have other issues, maybe with cleanliness of a pipe section. So you have 5%, 10%, 20% of the pipe where they say, well, our data quality here is low. We can't give you any conclusions about it. How does that make you feel? You just spent a whole bunch of money and you're not getting a 100% done test. You have to look at doing something else as well. And smart pigging is expensive. Prepping the pipe for it is costly because you've got to get that pipe as clean as you possibly can. And depending on how a company is operating, some do great maintenance pigging and some don't. Pig tools, depending on how complex they are and how new they are, sometimes they will find you stress corrosion cracking issues. Sometimes they'll find long seam trouble. Many times the smart pig is not set up to look for these unless you want to spend a lot more money. You have to know what risks you're facing in order to tell the pig vendor what tools you need, what kinds of analysis you need. There's a lot of communication that has to happen there before you go spend the money on the run. Hydrostatic testing is the third and remaining way to do integrity testing of a pipeline. Usually a company will take the pipe out of service, clean it, bring in the hydrotest company, and they'll go ahead and fill it with water and pressure it up to maybe 125% of an MOP or MAOP. Recent years, a short-term spike test has been added near the end of the hydrotest cycle. They'll usually go up to 150% of that max operating pressure for 30 minutes. Very interesting thing about hydrostatic testing. How long is that test result good for? When they take the pressure off and give you the pipe back, it tells you nothing about your future. It only tells you that as of the end of that test, your pipe was competent. It was holding pressure. There's no predictive value out of a hydrostatic test. There is predictive value out of the other two methods, ECDA and smart pigs, because they're allowing you to get data that you can trend forward with, you can compare backwards to other data sets with. Hydrotesting, yes, it's allowed. Yes, it serves a purpose in some cases, but it's a not very flexible set of test results. You get one answer and there ain't no interpretation about it. You either held the pressure or you did not. Back to my threat list, just for reference again. Anybody see a reference to CP interference or high voltage AC interference on this list? Not really, unless you call those external corrosion risks. So, looking at external or internal corrosion, I think everybody on the call knows about a corrosion cell. If we have a cathode, the anode, a metallic path connecting them, and then an electrolyte, we have corrosion, whether it's inside or outside. If we could eliminate any one of those four pieces, we've killed the corrosion circuit. A list of internal and external corrosion mechanisms. This is not the exhaustive list. This is kind of the high-profile names that I hope everybody's familiar with. And the one at the bottom, microbially influenced corrosion. The guys and girls doing internal corrosion work, you know that very well. But it happens on the soil side also, and probably a lot more often than we give it credit for. Galvanic series of metals. For those of you who put dissimilar metals together in the field, what do you see as the outcomes? Sometimes you'll have corrosion failures. Here's one. This was a 1-inch dry gas yard pipeline on a well pad that we found back in 2013 because it leaked. The perforation is in this pit right here to the left. And this pipe was not even 3 years old before that, call it quarter inch wall, failed. They never put CP on it because it was on a well pad. The contractor managed to ding that FBE coating really hard these three different times. And we then had stainless steel tubing made it up to this dry gas line about 20 feet to the left. The stainless then got buried along with this steel line. So this steel was corroding to protect the stainless in the common electrolyte. And then when you see those scalloped out bottoms in each of those pits, we had a lot of sulfates in the shallow soils. We had chlorides from salt also. We had microbes, and with a good crushed limestone base pad over the top, we had an oxygen deficient shallow soil column. I think the sulfate reducing bacteria did most of the damage here. Erosion corrosion. This was a piece of pipe out of a gas field down near Laredo where they hot tapped a new well's flow line in, and they had enough sand in that great gas flow, they shot a hole right through their gathering line on the other side. So external corrosion control, I think we all know we need coatings and then we need CP. Coating, I'm not going to go into the details here, but we want to get good coatings applied, which also means we've got to apply them to a good surface. Preparation, yeah, that's important. And when is the coating's best day? The first day it's on the job. Mother Nature goes to work on every coating for the rest of its life. This was a piece of pipe we were given to evaluate why it got a hole in it. And the hole wasn't in these two pits. It was about 4 inches to the right on a weld seam. And nobody knew these pits were even present until we took off this field-applied two-part epoxy. They never clean the surface of the metal. This was a 6-inch elbow coming up in a facility. They applied the FB or the two-part epoxy. And when you see all the dents and scrapes and mars, they didn't even let it cure before they backfilled right over the top of it. And then, of course, there was no CP on the facility. This fitting and the weld to the yard pipe, these two pits and then the failure, not in the picture, all happened in about 2.5 years. The threats that caused it, external corrosion. But look at fabrication and joining. I didn't show you a picture of the weld seam, but it was poor quality welding. No surface prep and cleaning of the pipe, poor coating application, and then backfilled it too soon, didn't even let it cure. So is it incorrect ops? Yeah. And then no CP ever applied. This was a piece of pipe down in the Maverick Basin that had been laid the year before, and somebody came along and potholed it. Lucky thing is we dug it up as part of putting in some AC mitigation and we found this damage. You can tell the CP was working. That's the good news. But this is less than a year old and we lost how many different chunks of coating there from somebody putting a wand in the ground to air knife or hydrovac. We did an integrity evaluation up in North Dakota in 2015 and 16. And the good news is we found alignment sheets. Here's one of those sheets. This gave us a tremendous amount of information about what was underground. This is fantastic. When you find the files, hang on to them, scan them, save them, teach from them. This is just so valuable, you can't even put a dollar figure on how much we did for the client by finding and preserving these records. So we found out it was 188 wall. Was it still 188 when we went to work on it? No, probably not. We found 6 CP test stations over a 3.5-mile run. That's according to the material summary on this sheet right here. We didn't find them all. I think we found two, and we were pretty well convinced the others had been destroyed. How many years ago? We sure don't know. Notice that casings are called out on the material list. Anybody here like cased crossings? Well, we got them. Then they're calling out the factory applied coating on the line pipe as something called mobile thin film. The coatings at girth welds, we have no idea what they did. It's not called out here. Later, we got to dig it up and found out it was tape wrap. ERW pipe from 1980. That's not so bad. If it was pre-70, we'd be a lot more worried. But again, all of this is pipeline integrity information we get to evaluate. It's a gold mine. Mobile thin film. What the heck is that? Well, it's an organic coating similar to coal tar. It was made of 100% solids because even back in 1980, people were trying to limit the amount of VOCs they were making and losing off to the environment or making an explosive atmosphere out of. And so it was applied at the coating mill by heat, and then 40-foot joints, of course, came to the field. Coal tar enamel is what they were trying to replace. Coal tar got applied in thicknesses of really 100 mils and more as the standard, unwritten standard, if you will, way back when. And Mobil came out with their thin film to say, hey, you only need 12 to 14 mils of this. It's going to be great. What happened? Our industry experts, Mike Ames being one of them, my technical partner, said that it quickly fell out of favor because soil stress would rub it right off the pipe. So the client needed to go dig up portions of the pipe, evaluate coating issues. I don't know how much they did. We did a couple digs for them, and we've actually got a better picture from one on a similar pipe in 2017. This is Wyoming, but the same material, but this one had a poly wrap put over the top of it. That piece of pipe exposed in between the red lines is where the poly wrap and the thin film got rubbed off, probably by soil stress, active corrosion, and guess what? That's the only place cathodic protection can help because the pipe is exposed. When you wrap poly over the pipe, that is a cathodic shield, so you can't apply CP effectively unless you get bare pipe and nothing else of concern. I think we all know if that film is lifted, delaminated from the pipe off to the left and the right, we can't get CP to that part because of the plastic overlay. This is a piece of the plastic film and the mobile thin film that our guy got off the pipe and brought back to us here in Bernie. If you have pipes with mobile thin film on it, you can apply CP. If you have the plastic overwrap, you got shielding issues along with a bad coating, good luck. Back to those material lists and some casing information. Actually, sorry, off the alignment sheet. So 12.75 OD carrier pipe with the, or excuse me, casing pipe with a 6-inch oil carrier pipe. That was a big inner space. We did not get to do rehab of those casings. This was crossing a little county road. This company had hundreds and hundreds of these case crossings. And my fear is more than half of them were shorted, be it electrolytic or metallic. This is more data on the case crossing. Our C-scan work on this pipe showed the casing likely shorted. Then we got to rehab some casings going into and out of large facilities. Two of these were rail terminals in the Bakken. One was a major gas plant. Does any of this look like good quality casing work? I would not say so. Then we found these. Anybody bend your carrier pipe to come into or go out of a casing? Doesn't that bend continue inside the casing and probably make you metal to metal and fail all your spacers? Just some really, really questionable design followed by construction. And these pipes were between 4 and 8 years old when we worked on them. This was relatively new stuff, done very poorly. Isolation fittings, interference between CP systems. How do you get isolations failed? Here's one of my favorite photos. Our ISO kit is inside of my little yellow circle, and we found this to not be isolated. Why? We're sitting on a skid with two metal conduits bridged across. We have stainless instrument tubing up high that's bridging across. No effective isolation. We ended up at this one gas compressor station having three sales companies who were receiving product out of this, giving us CP, and then our own company having CP. We had four different CP systems or sets of systems all combined here. How to apply CP? I don't know that I need to dwell on these a whole lot, but the galvanic anode approach is one. They are low power systems. And there's a picture of something we've put in on a military base where we've got two mag anodes separated, not by enough distance right there. They're actually close enough. They'll interfere a little bit with one another for current output. But all the ductile iron fittings joined by bond wires, and then the anodes would be wired up to a test station at grade once all this stuff gets closed up. To put in an impressed current system, this is a quick look in schematic fashion of what an impressed current system with a deep anode bed and a rectifier would look like. And it also has a bond box to two different pipes with variable resistors where we might be able to balance the amount of current we give to each structure. A crew working on a deep anode bed installation. Internal corrosion and the control of it. Internal corrosion is a big, big issue. I wish we had more people trained in this art and more companies using the proper steps of doing internal corrosion control. The first piece of controlling internal corrosion is maintenance pigging. Running cleaning pigs through a pipe and finding out what is staying behind, what is dropping out of your product flow. After that, you learn what those things look like, you study the risks, you're probably going to use some chemical treatments, corrosion inhibitors, biocides. If you have paraffin and the Eagle Ford plating out on your pipe, you may have water and bugs and junk under that paraffin. So what is pipeline cleaning? Simple, the act of removing foreign material from the pipeline. Physical methods, the pigs, and chemical methods, making stuff let loose of a pipe wall, getting it out the end of the pipe. Water, sand, formation silts and clays, waxes, paraffins, some guy's lunchbox from when the pipe was built, all kinds of things we've heard of coming out of maintenance pig runs. Simply running a pig does not tell you that you have successfully cleaned the line. I was taught by a very knowledgeable guy a few years ago, you want to use a progressive set of pigs, maybe even run them all in the same day or the same week. You start with a foam pig, you go to a scraper cup pig, you might go to a brush pig. Each one of them is going to get different stuff pulled out of the line. And then if you're not maintenance pigging, but you are applying chemicals, how do the chemicals get to the steel wall and do their work? They may never see the right place to go. And here's one of the reasons why they won't. When you don't clean the pipe, what builds up? This kind of stuff. You don't know exactly where it is. You don't know how thick it is until you clean it all out. How would you like to come to your receiver and look at this? And what if it caught on fire, which a lot of these are capable of doing? So this pipe was not being maintenance pigged frequently enough. Would everybody agree on that? The steps for pipeline cleaning, a pretty simple set of steps. Obtain and evaluate your deposits as well as all the details about your product. specify what your goals are for cleaning. It's probably that you want to eliminate internal corrosion rates of anything over 1 mil per year, which I believe we set as the standard. Select and design a cleaning system, or process maybe is the better word. Clean the pipe with maintenance pigs. It often takes multiple passes with multiple pigs, and again, different types of cleaning pigs. Then evaluate your progress and what your overall success is. Once again, it's the plan it, do it, check it, act on what you learned, round and round circle. Then go repeat what you did right. If you did something that didn't work well, modify the process, try something else, talk to a different chemical vendor. If the chemicals you're using now don't get rid of all the risks that you have. And the frequency of pigging, the frequency of chemical injection, you have to study your data to say how often is good enough. Chemical treatments. We will use amines to scavenge out hydrogen sulfide and carbon dioxide. They can be in oils, they can be in gases. Those are both acid gases and can cause huge internal corrosion issues. Hydrogen sulfide, often with water in low points, CO2, often with a little bit of water, and top of the pipeline corrosion risk with it. If you have oxygen in your internal gas flows or as a gas fraction in a multi-phase flow, you're in bad trouble. Oxygen at anything over 20 parts per billion inside a pipe can be a huge driver of internal corrosion. You might use alcohols to entrain water in the liquid product and keep water moving. Whenever water drops out, you're going to get bad things happening there. You'll use biocides, bacteria, fungi, other microorganisms, all produce acids as waste products. They'll stick to the walls and grow there because you're feeding them food all the time with your product flow. And those acid wastes they produce cause pitting corrosion. How about atmospheric corrosion? I had a guy call me up back in 2014. Cal, I had this load line off my 400-barrel oil tank leak this morning. He sent me this picture and said, what the hell caused this? Why wasn't my CP working? I said, Matt, was this pipe above ground? Yeah. Remember, CP can't work in the air. It only works in the soil. Oh, yeah, right. He was down in the Maverick Basin. The soils down there are saltier than the sand down at the beach. They're clays and silts with huge concentrations of table salt, sodium chloride, along with gypsum. Mother Nature put it all there. You can get the wind blowing, and all that stuff blows up as dust. Well, what also happened to this unpainted set of pipe threads every night? It got dewfall on it. So what you get is dust on the pipe threads. Add water thanks to the dew, you now have a salt water right there in contact with your cut threads. Cut threads represent higher energy steel with all those nice crevices and peaks. This thing corroded out in what we would have all called dry air conditions in 3 years. But guess what? It wasn't dry air conditions once we figured out the various things going on. And yeah, those threads chewed all the heck. Those are down at the 6 o'clock where that dewfall would run down and collect as droplets night after night, year after year. Paint the metal. What other options do we have? When do you need to inspect pipelines? Well, how about when new crossing comes over you? You're required to get in that hole and evaluate your pipe anytime it's exposed. Now I say that, somebody's gonna tell me, oh, but that's a non-regulated line. And I'm gonna tell you, do you want its integrity to be good? If so, go there, get in the hole and look at it. Take care of every asset as if it's regulated. It'll last longer, it'll cost you less over time. Open the ditch and what do you find? Again, every time something gets daylighted, go look. On this left side, this 2-inch gathering line was not a pipe we knew about. We actually had a signal on the still soil-covered 4-inch line underneath it. And then on the right side, that's self-explanatory. Coating coming right off, improper surface prep probably, and just lousy results, except, okay, it's shiny metal. We have CP on it. That's the good news. AC-induced corrosion risks. These have come into view more over the last 20 to 30 years. They weren't evaluated by my ASME guys back in the 30s to the 60s or 70s. We know about them now. We do other presentations, Mike Ames and I, on this. We had something on NACE International just a couple weeks ago. That was very kind of them to have us in. But I'll remind everybody here, are we building more power lines and increasing the use of electricity over time? Absolutely we are, which means every pipe mile you have, you've got to be looking at AC voltages. You have to be looking at AC safety risks and AC-induced corrosion risks, and not just one time. You've got to do it every year. Finally, NACE impact study was brought out in March of 2016. The main points I want to make here are you need to go to your bosses. You need to go to your upper management if you're operating pipelines, facilities, high-value assets that have corrosion. Show your management that doing corrosion control, doing cathodic protection, doing coating repair, doing better design, construction, and construction inspection will make you money. There is a return on that investment. It is not a cost of doing business. You're investing in a better quality asset. It pays you back. In the end, we own the problems. We don't have somebody else to hand them off to. I was invited to go up and look at a firewater tank for a propane storage cavern in Minnesota. I didn't go in that tank. I don't think any of us would. And that tank was 30 years old, had internal anodes. Don't know when they were installed. They stopped working a number of years before I got there. And that was what the hats looked like. And I told them, please go buy a new tank, replace this one. Is there a better answer than that? So with that, I believe that managing our asset integrity makes them last longer. I think it makes them operate more safely, and I think it makes them operate less expensively. And again, design it right, build it right, inspect it. That's where we always start if we get the chance. Thank you all very much, and I will entertain any questions. Anita, did you have an announcement you wanted to make? Ah, okay. Here's a good question from Drew Gomer. B31-8S that I showed you, I'm going to tell you that threat list applies to any pipeline. It could be a water line, oil line, gas line, multi-phase line. Nothing on that list would, I think, knock out a particular type of product. Those are very broad categories. And again, how you apply them to a particular line, it depends, of course, on what your product is, what your contaminants are, and so on. Great question. Thank you. We got a few minutes left if anybody else wants to chime in.
Well, I guess while we're waiting for any other questions, I'd just like to say thank you to
everybody.
Okay, I'm listening.
I'm not hearing anybody. Who's still there?
Oh, can you hear me, Cal? Cal?
This is Ted. I can hear you guys.
Oh, Oh, hi, Ted. Okay. Yeah, Ted can hear me. Okay, very good. Thanks, Ted. So I just like to, if we don't have any other questions, just say thank you. Let's see. Oh, hi, everybody.
A question, Anita. If Cal can hear, if not, maybe he can yell across the room, unless he's at his house. So I would like Cal, and I may have to jump off because I'm sorry I got to attend another meeting, but I want, if you can explain the significance of reading criteria at 850 in the office position. Recently went through a PHMSA audit. You know, we're typically looking in the past for 850 on criteria. It seems like they have shifted to, you know, the regulators at least, that 850 off is basically the criteria that they're looking for, even over 100 millivolt shift, et cetera. Have you had any experience in hearing about that or anyone that you're working with?
Let's see.
Maybe he still can't hear me.
Let me go. Yeah, his speakers might be messed up.
Yeah, he's muted.
Oh, he's muted. Hold on, let me go get him to unmute.
Okay, there I is. Just did. Thank you. Sorry about that.
Okay.
My remote speaker's battery gave out.
Okay, Cal, did you hear Jeff's question?
Actually, no.
Oh, yeah, Cal, real quick, just because we're up against the clock here. Recently, in some inspections we've been through, federal level inspections, you know, they're really putting it to our procedures as far as managing an 850 off criteria, which goes against, God, I can't remember the SP number for NACE, but it's like 1160 or 1060 or something like that, versus 850 on is the criteria we're trying to meet. So, I mean, you ran into that with any of the regulators, auditors, et cetera, where they're giving scrutiny to an 850 or an off reading that is sub 850?
Okay, Jeff, here's what I've seen. And this has really come into play by some big pipeline operators over the last 5 years. Even with old pipelines with terrible coatings, they have decided to try to meet the minus 850 instant off criterion, what I would call criterion number two. And in some cases, they have built massive CP systems with which to do it. I think that's a terrible approach, but what they also did was they took their integrity management program language and said, this will be our standard to show we're applying enough protection. So they boxed themselves in. On old pipelines, I would tell you, I much prefer the polarization shift criterion, because when you try to go to the minus 850 instant off with poor quality coatings, you need massive amounts of current. You end up causing huge interference issues to your neighbors. Now, you also referenced the minus 850 on criterion, which is really still in the federal rule, because the federal rule, unless they just modified it, still refers to NACE SPO 169 as of 2002 or maybe 2007. I think we all understand the minus 850 on has to take into account what IR drops, what artificial voltages are also being measured. We don't like the use of that one unless you're dealing with a little tiny galvanic anode system. So to say the regulators have now grabbed on to this minus 850 instant off as the only way to go, I think it's because these major pipeline operators have written in their program documents they think it's the only way to go. I think it's been a terrible choice because it has led to us seeing more interference concern, more interference damage, without anybody really gaining better protection. The other thing I'll add to that is it's far better, in my view, to build 5 or 10 or 20 smaller CP systems along these older pipelines than it is to build 3 or 4 massive CP systems at fewer locations. And then you're trying to collect back these ungodly large amounts of CP current. That's a whole philosophical discussion that needs to be held there, really at the highest levels of these corrosion roundtable type folks at some big companies. they have gone the wrong direction with these older pipes, bad coatings, and trying to apply these massive amounts of current.
Well, I would say that during this exchange, basically the language in our procedure for measuring pipe's full potentials was asking for like 100 millivolt shift or meeting 850 on criteria, basically right out of, you know, the SP that you mentioned, 169.
Right.
I got a lot of flack from the auditor. We ended up changing it. And as soon as he left, I think I changed it right back. It was per the standard. I just didn't want to fight with him anymore about it, but I'm glad you gave us some perspective on kind of how that's kind of come to fruition.
And Jeff, I will tell you that even on one pipeline, we've told some customers, keep both options 2 and 3 in your integrity management plan. Maybe you even keep the entire standard in, as you just said you're doing. I think that's your safest bet. It gives you local flexibility, and you are meeting the rule requirement by using the standard.
Well, thanks, Cap. Thanks, Cal. Appreciate you joining and helping us get through an early lunch today.
Very happy to do it.
All right. Do we have any other questions?
Nope.
Well, thank you, Cal. And if anybody needs a letter, just feel free to email the section and we'll get something sent over to you. Thank you, everybody.
Again, thank you all very much. It's my pleasure. We'll do something again soon. Take care.
Thank you.